Today is Wednesday, September 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the United States observed a moment of silence today, remembering the terrorist attacks that took place 18 years ago.
This is your anniversary of personal and permanent loss.
Also ahead, Britain's parliament may be suspended. The drama surrounding Brexit has not ended. And we take a preview of tomorrow's Democratic presidential candidate debate in the United States. All those stories are coming up next. Americans on Wednesday are marking the 18th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks that killed almost 3,000 people in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Memorial events took place at all three locations. In New York, the Bell of Hope rang out at St. Paul's Chapel in New York Wednesday morning to mark the moment at 8:46 local time when the first of two planes hit the World Trade Center Twin Towers. It's been rung every year on the anniversary since 2002. Barbara Salvador and Judy Bram Murphy, who both lost loved ones 18 years ago, read some of the names of those killed in the attack in New York.
Lorraine Antigua, Seema David Ioma, and my brother Peter Lewis Freund, and my cousin Timothy Patrick McSweeney, both FDNY. We love you, we miss you, and you'll always be America's heroes.
And my husband Brian Murphy. Brian, we all miss you and think about you every day.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence attended ceremonies in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, near where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed after passengers took control from the terrorists who had hijacked the plane with the intention of crashing it into the White House. President Donald Trump participated in a ceremony at the Pentagon for families of those killed.
But for the families who join us, this is your anniversary of personal and permanent loss. It's the day that has replayed in your memory 1,000 times over, the last kiss, the last phone call, the last time hearing those precious words, I love you.
Joining us on the phone is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It is a sad day over here at the Pentagon. They listed all the names when they started the ceremony, and there's a name, Dana Falkenberg, that gives me chills every single time I hear her name. She was just 3 years old. She was on the plane that went into the Pentagon 18 years ago, and it just breaks my heart to think that she could be 21 years old and living her life now, and instead she's one of the many Americans gone.
And this was a rather large event taking place at the Pentagon today, which really began with the unfurling of the American flag on the side of the building.
Yes, that's right. It started very early in the morning, and then we had the ceremony where President Trump spoke afterwards. The family, pretty much the families of the victims, get left alone to walk in the memorial. We do not go over there. We give them their space, even though we are reporting on this event, because it means so much to millions of Americans across the country and to people across the world, because it did change so much in the world's history. I mean, we're still in Afghanistan right now. The United States has 14,000 troops fighting. There's been peace talks that were discussed. President Trump actually mentioned those peace talks that never happened, because he called them off because an American was killed a few days ago, but still very much in the minds of Americans and in the minds of people across the globe.
Exactly. And the events in 2001, 18 years ago, also kind of changed the direction of defense spending in the United States.
It did. So there was actually a downward trajectory of spending, because when the Cold War ended, the big competitor, Russia, had fallen, and there was no need for so much military spending. They hit a low point in around 1998, and then the attacks on September 11th happened, and that changed everything. The United States went into Iraq, Afghanistan. They started a surplus of spending, and then we saw with the Obama administration, it started to go down again. And now we've seen a surge again, and then that's because of a resurgent Russia that we've noticed, and also the growth of China.
Speaking to your contacts in the Pentagon and other sources, how has the military adjusted with this post-2001 environment with so many conflicts taking place around the globe?
Well, it's definitely a situation where the defense spending has gone up to accommodate everything that the military is doing. I mean, the military is all across the globe, not just in war zones, Iraq, Afghanistan, but also helping other nations build their defenses. I was speaking earlier with the Assistant Secretary of State for Military Affairs, Clark Cooper, and he was explaining to me that it's not just building up for the United States, it's being able to offer different capabilities for our allies. Because as he explained it, if the United States isn't offering a capability to an ally, then that allows a Russia or a China to come in and, you know, take the crumbs, as he explained it to me, or the whole loaf, as he explained it to me. And so it's not just that the United States feels that it has to keep spending to keep up with Russia and China. It doesn't. It is ahead of them at this point. But they worry that if a China were to give another country a capability like Huawei 5G, that they could take over, listen in into America's activities with its partners and allies, and ultimately make the United States less safe.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
After the 2001 attacks, the United States created a terrorism screening database that collected names of suspected and known terrorists so they could be kept from entering the country. Saba Sakhan has a story about a federal judge who has ruled the list unconstitutional.
The Department of Homeland Security's terrorist watch list is believed to contain over 1 million names of foreigners and American citizens. It does not prevent individuals from boarding flights, but can impose restrictions on their travel. A group of 23 Muslim Americans sued the government over the list in April 2019. Arguing they could not adequately challenge their inclusion in the list. This month, a federal court in its ruling declared the list unconstitutional.
Next, we'll be hearing from Hassan Shibli, one of our 23 brave plaintiffs.
Hassan Shibli was one of the plaintiffs in this case.
I've been waiting 15 years for this victory. For 15 years, been harassed and targeted by the government, even though I've done nothing wrong. Treated like a second-class citizen, stigmatized, profiled, harassed, treated like a criminal.
Critics of the database, including the Council on Islamic Relations and American Civil Liberties Union, say the list has long had vague standards, been cloaked in secrecy, and included names of people who should never have been on it. Still, a number of U.S. lawmakers consider the list critical for American security, Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
We are facing a global war on terror. We are facing, in particular, radical Islamic terrorists who have murdered Americans, who have murdered our allies, and we need to be clear-eyed and vigilant, preventing terrorism and stopping terrorism before it happens.
Federal Court Judge Anthony Trenga said in his judgment that the program in its current form does not meet the due process rights provided by the Constitution to a U.S. citizen. Lina Masri of CARE says if someone's name appears on the list, even if it's taken off, the record still exists in the database, and there is no known way to remove the name.
So having records expunged in the terror screening database of everybody who's been listed in the watch list that is removed from the watch list, including our clients, it needs to occur.
The judge's ruling means that both the defendants and the plaintiffs must propose changes to the database program. A final ruling is expected later this month. Saba Shahan, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Wednesday, a Scottish court ruled that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's move to suspend Parliament was unlawful. Plus, Brexit Party leader Nigel Farage offered Johnson an election pact, but warned that unless there was a clean break Brexit, the Conservatives would take a real kicking in any election and could not win a majority. And Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the opposition Labour Party, told reporters he wanted there to be a new referendum on EU membership before any national elections. While the British Parliament is suspended, The debate over Brexit is anything but. To help make sense of what is taking place, we're joined now by Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, what is going on with Parliament?
Well, another extraordinary day of twists and turns in Britain's Brexit saga. It's all so unpredictable, it keeps us on our toes. Today we had two contradictory rulings from the British courts, which I think is the most important development of the day. The first from Edinburgh, the Scottish capital, where judges at the Court of Session, three judges, unanimously ruled that the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, had effectively misled the Queen, that he had asked her to suspend Parliament, in effect not because he wanted to present a new policy platform, which was his reasoning, but in fact his intention was to stymie Parliament, in their words, to prevent lawmakers from scrutinising the government. And then we had a separate ruling in London, at London's High Court, which said the opposite, that in fact Boris Johnson's decision to try to suspend Parliament was a political matter and one that the court should not get involved in. The summation of all of this is that it will go to the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, on Tuesday next week, where the judges there will have a very difficult job of deciphering between Scottish law, which incidentally is different to English law, and decide which side to go with, and whether Boris Johnson acted illegally in suspending Parliament. And just digest that phrase for a minute, that perhaps the British Prime Minister will be found to have acted illegally.
Now, if the Supreme Court sides with a Scottish court, would that mean that Parliament would be ordered back into session?
That would be the intention of such a ruling. The difficulty is that with no written constitution, we don't really have any rules to follow in terms of where the judiciary and the courts fit into the executive and the legislature. And the government has indicated that it will not act, certainly before that ruling next Tuesday. So we just await to see what the government's reaction would be. If the government decided not to follow the ruling, then I think there would be further court cases. It's also worth saying that Parliament anyway was due to break for the party conferences, but opposition MPs are now demanding that the Parliament is reconvened this very hour. In fact, some opposition lawmakers went back into Parliament just to make the point that it should be sitting right now. So we're set up again for another extraordinary week of confrontation next week.
Henry Ridgewell is in London and follows the Brexit, among other stories for us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Among other top stories in the world, China says it will exempt a handful of U.S.-made products from the latest round of retaliatory tariffs sparked by the escalating trade war between the two global economic powers. An Iranian government spokesman says the departure of National Security Advisor John Bolton could allow U.S. President Donald Trump's administration to deal with Iran in a less biased manner. The body of Zimbabwe's longtime ruler, Robert Mugabe, has arrived in the capital of Harare, where it was met by President Emmerson Mnangagwa and a full military delegation. You'll be able to find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History report in a new study published in the journal Nature that there are actually three species of the electric eel swimming in the swamps, streams, creeks, and rivers across northern South America. It's been long thought that there was only one species of the electric eel. The researchers say all of the specimens examined at first looked pretty much the same. However, an analyzation of their DNA indicated genetic differences between the three species. They later found subtle physical differences in each of the species. The study also suggests that one of the species could generate up to 860 volts of power, which is more than any other animal and is about 260 volts more than the other electric eel species. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Speaking in Berlin, Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong, who rose to fame during the 2014 pro-democracy protests, remains a central figure today, said Germany should do more than issue statements condemning what's taking place in China.
Germany should immediately suspend the sale and export of riot weapons to Hong Kong police. Germany should also suspend trade negotiation with China and Hong Kong until human rights issue is put on the agenda, and should consider enacting laws that set standard for companies operating in Xinjiang and sanction those that fail to live up to European ideals of human rights.
The 22-year-old activist, who landed in Berlin Monday evening to attend a newspaper-sponsored event at the German parliament celebrating human rights activists around the world, pledged that protests would not be lulled into complacency by the decision of the city's government to drop a contested extradition law. His fellow activist, Chongqing Kwong, said they were willing to pay the ultimate price.
I would say after seeing fellow protesters and fellow Hong Kongers committed suicide to protest against the bill, seeing friends injured, seeing families being scared, I would say I am ready for all the consequences that may come with the fight that we are now in.
According to China's ambassador to Berlin, the meeting between Germany's foreign minister and Wong will damage relations with China. There was no immediate response from Germany's foreign ministry. Palestinian refugees in Lebanon's Burj al Barajna camp brushed off today a plan by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. The shop owner said Netanyahu can say whatever he wants. It's not up to him to make a decision about annexing the West Bank or even bombing Gaza, as has happened in the past. Netanyahu announced on Tuesday his intention to annex the Jordan Valley, a large swath of the occupied West Bank, if he wins a closely contested election just a week away. Palestinian chief peace negotiator Zaeb Erekat called the planned move a war crime under international law governing the occupied territory. The announcement came as a UN report warns of Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories are facing a socioeconomic crisis that is bordering on collapse. Lisa Schlein has that part of the story.
UN economists warn the situation is worsening and is at the breaking point. UNCTAD reported the Palestinian economy grew by less than 1% last year. It says the economy in the West Bank grew by 3% but shrank by 7% in Gaza. Mahmoud El-Khafif is the UNCTAD coordinator of the assistance to the Palestinian people. He says the unemployment rate in Gaza has soared above 50%.
With this high unemployment rate, poverty is climbing. Almost one in two Palestinians in occupied Palestinian territory is in need of humanitarian assistance. Poverty rate is up to 29%. Actually, poverty rate in Gaza is 53%.
El-Khafif says Israel's 12-year blockade of Gaza is preventing the economy from developing. He says the situation has been worsening over the last 2 years because the money that used to be transferred by the Palestinian National Authority into Gaza has shrunk substantially. He says a huge drop in donor support also is strangling the Palestinian economy. He says the economy is being further weakened by the Israeli ban on the importation of a long list of what Israel authorities consider dual-use essential technological and intermediate goods.
Israel claims that this dual list could have non-civilian use or military use, and therefore the Palestinians cannot import. This includes fertilizers and wood with a certain specification and so on. And of course, you can see that why the Palestinian economy is completely dependent on the Israeli economy.
El-Khafif says economic dependence on Israel accounts for 80% of Palestinian exports and supplies 58% of its imports. UNCTAD reports occupation has prevented the Palestinian people from developing their oil and natural gas resources in Gaza and the West Bank. The estimated accumulated losses, it says, are worth billions of dollars. Israel and Egypt imposed the blockade of the Gaza Strip in 2007 after Hamas, a militant group calling for the destruction of Israel, took control of the territory. Israeli authorities say the blockade is necessary to protect Israeli citizens from terrorism, rocket attacks, and other hostile activity by preventing the imported goods, which could be used for military purposes against Israel, from entering Gaza. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The 10 top contenders for the U.S. Democratic Party presidential nomination will face off in Houston, Texas, Thursday night. Polls show former Vice President Joe Biden maintaining his lead. And as Michael Sullivan reports, the others hope to gain ground as they head toward next year's party preference votes and a U.S. presidential election.
Earlier debates were spaced out over two nights, including this June face-off broadcast by NBC News. Thursday, 10 candidates will share the stage on a single night at Texas Southern University, an historically black college in Houston. Some contenders have dropped out. Others who polled poorly or failed to meet stricter fundraising requirements were excluded, including Colorado Senator Michael Bennet. Frontrunner Joe Biden says he can beat incumbent Trump. He'll be flanked by two candidates from the left wing of the party, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. California's Kamala Harris and the others will try to rise above the clamor.
Those who are not in what looks to me to be the top three now, Biden, Sanders, and Warren, are going to be fighting for air. Are going to be fighting for the ability to raise some more money, to get some more name recognition.
She says it worked last time for Harris, who launched a pointed attack on Biden. This time, Harris may highlight her plan to reform the criminal justice system, which she says is unfair to minorities and young offenders. Healthcare, gun violence, immigration, issues on which there is broad agreement among Democrats, but dispute over details, are likely points of contention. U.S. President Donald Trump will be a target, with news that he has fired yet another aide, National Security Advisor John Bolton. There will be claims his administration is in disarray. And in a week that marks the 18th anniversary of a terrorist attack on America, candidates will ask, who can inspire confidence and who can win the election? Analyst Jeffy says Trump will make his presence felt, if only through Twitter.
This time, Donald Trump is the 11th man up on the debate stage yet again.
As the political process continues, heading toward the November 2020 election. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The early release of hundreds of convicted rapists, murderers, and drug criminals has embarrassed Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, with his justice minister saying they were ineligible to be freed because of the severity of their crimes. Some 1,700 felons serving life sentences have quietly walked free under a good behavior program in the 3 years since Duterte swept to power, promising to wage a national war on corruption, drugs, and crime. Duterte last week demanded that 1,700 convicts surrender, offering bounties of $19,200 for each if they failed to comply. As of Wednesday, 185 have turned themselves in. The Bahamas government says that there are about 2,500 people on its list of those missing after Hurricane Dorian, but those names have yet to be cross-checked against the list of people evacuated from the disaster-struck islands or staying in shelters. More than a week after Dorian smashed thousands of homes on the country's Grand Bahama and Abaco Islands, the death toll stands at 50 and is expected to rise. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Rob McClain, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.